of a mountain structure or something that causes the gathering of those charged particles more in that area more likely than in other areas. Certainly because you have areas like you said, in Florida, that are very much more susceptible than other areas. So it does have to do with landscape. But this is something that I think is not really understood by just about anybody, but we're getting closer, Dick. Keep the price up.
Repeater, time out. Call from 4148.
I vaguely remember Maynard Hill in that article in Flying Models magazine way back in 1970, roughly, telling us that as he flew his radio-controlled model airplane on a dry day, this automatic leveling system did a beautiful job. When he flew it on a day where a thundercloud was approaching, I think he saw all kinds of wild effects. In other words, the normal roughly 2 volts per meter of vertical displacement of charge through that mildly conducting air got disturbed in all kinds of crazy ways as a cloud front was approaching, as a storm front was approaching. I think there were times when the airplane behaved so crazily that he, by remote control, had to turn off his automatic leveler. It didn't do what he expected. I vaguely remember him saying something along those lines. And he couldn't fly it under a tree. He couldn't fly it near a tree. It didn't work well on a rainy day and so on. So there is giving us some hints. I'm envisioning a moist cloud of charge of the leading front of a storm approaching your or my area. Let me drop. Because the moist air in that approaching front is more conductive, portions of it tend to be at an equipotential. As that moist, lighter air, lighter in pounds per cubic meter, starts flowing over top of the air that's in our dry area where you and I are standing, and we're watching the storm front approaching us, I think it starts lying on top of that air and squeezing it down. Why would it squeeze it down? There, I'm not sure.
I have an idea.
But it's displacing it. Okay, as it squeezes, if it did squeeze it down, and the dry air has now got this great big voltage potential across it, which in volts per meter is continuously increasing because of the squeeze. So tell me why you think it could squeeze, Glenn. Go ahead.
I think it's due to a dissimilarity in air pressures. In other words, if you look at the leading edge of a storm many times, the air on the leading edge of the storm is violent. It's got heavy wind. It's got rain. It's got energy in it. And the air on the other end, where you're standing before the storm hits, is very still and it's calm, and the air pressure there is very, very stable. And what's happening is now with all that wind power and that energy and velocity of moving into that other air that's, you know, basically kind of still, you have two dynamic situations going on with differentials in air pressure, and one is forcing itself, the storm front that's moving in, is moving a whole new air pressure, an air mass, on top of an existing air mass that's already there with the force of wind behind it and all that energy in it. So, K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
The storm itself always has a lower barometric pressure. The reason it has a lower barometric pressure is heavy convection is taking place. Something triggers the situation. The hotter air down low starts rising because it's lighter. As it rises to higher altitudes where the surrounding air is cooler and lower in air pressure, the moisture in that air starts condensing. The water vapor starts turning into liquid water, small droplets at first. The heat of vaporization is significant, 540 calories per gram. Each gram of water that forms must release 540 calories of heat. That creates a hot chimney in the middle where the moist air is condensing and forming small or large water droplets. That heat given off creates a chimney effect that sucks in more air and continues the process. So the dry air where you're standing, where you and I are standing, is being slowly sucked into this rising convection cell that is the storm cloud where the low pressure area is. And your barometer in your dry area will slowly go to lower and lower numbers as that storm cloud gets closer to you. So our dry air is being sucked into this thing. And in the process, I guess it's decreasing in its altitude because this moist air is about to flow over top of it. So I think that's part of the squeezing process that continuously is increasing the volts per meter, because the charge, there's a certain amount of charge on the bottom of that cloud. The volts per meter in your currently dry air is being squeezed, and higher volts per centimeter are taking place, and eventually you're going to start getting a corona discharge aided by cosmic rays, and you make that first leak.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And you generate that first leader stroke for the first 40 meters, and then from there on it's a runaway cascading or chain reaction like process. I'm slowly trying to confirm, I'm slowly trying to compose a scenario that sort of fits what you and I think is the usual events on an approaching storm front. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
And it's interesting, too, if you ever look on, like, weather.com and you look at those weather patterns and watch, it's very interesting to watch the radar images of the storm as it's moving along. And you always see the clearing edge in front and the area that it's moving over. Because if you've ever witnessed the storms, you know, by eye, standing outside, you see that black cloud coming. And if you watch it on a computer screen and look at what's actually happening in that leading edge, that's where all the lightning is. But what's funny is if you look at those clouds, they color them all red. But the reality is there isn't as much lightning in the middle of the storm as there is on the edge. Have you ever noticed that as well, Dick? K2RW, KC2QIQ.
I sure have, Glenn. So that leading edge is where the majority of the lightning is. And that's part of what makes it so dangerous for a golfer. Something one or two or three people per year die on the black course in Bethpage. When I was caddying there, I was hearing a couple of lightning deaths every single year. And I think it's a combination of the right kind of hilly terrain, a really tough course, really gung-ho golfers, because it's a tough course, the pros go there, and they're in relatively dry air. They know a storm is approaching, but they say, hey, I'm going to finish this round before the storm gets here. And they're standing on a high hill with this metal object in their hand. They swing it up about to take a shot, and zap, they die. So they're in the leading front, not realizing that even though the majority of the lightning in the leading edge of the storm is a couple of miles away from you, occasionally you're going to get a rogue lightning strike in an area where you think the storm hasn't hit yet. No rain has hit. You've got some black clouds approaching rapidly, and you think you're in a safe area for the time being. And you think you're going to complete that round before the storm hits you. And so a smarter person will find cover when that storm starts approaching. If you can hear lightning at all in the distance, you're probably in trouble to be on that course. What do you think, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW?
I would have to agree, Dick. Certainly, open golf courses like that, beachfronts, another place can be very, very dangerous, or near large bodies of water. There are definitely areas where you have big open areas and you can get trapped. And in something like that, one of the key things to do is always know that where your shelter is. So if a storm is coming in, you can get out from away from those big open areas where basically, in other words, a good rule of thumb is if you don't want to be struck by lightning, be in an area that's wind restricted. In other words, if there's a very good possibility that if you don't feel a draft or you don't feel a wind, more than likely you won't get struck by lightning. But if you're in an area where you can feel a breeze, get out of there. K4IW, KC2QIQ.
In the case of that beachfront, what would you do? Run into your car?
Find a location where there's very little wind activity. If the storm is coming from behind you, stand to the side of a building. In other words, if there's a building there and you can't get inside of it, stand on the side of the building where the wind is covered. Don't stand on the windy side. In other words, any place where the exchange of air movement is going to be moving, there's going to be charge there. Wherever that air is moving, that's where the charge, that's where all the motivation is taking place. If you can get to a still area, if you can get inside a car where there's no draft or no wind, a tunnel, but there again, a tunneled area, make sure that there's no draft through there. So any place where you can get out of wind movement, that would be my suggestion, Dick.
If the wind was blowing from the west, would I therefore hide on the eastern side of the building?
If there's no draft, a very simple test is just to hold a small rag in your hand. If that rag gets blown, or you see your jacket, ruffling a little bit, you're not out of it. But if all of a sudden everything is nice and still, you can't feel your hair moving, your jacket isn't ruffling, and you could hold a cloth out in front of you and it doesn't move, you're probably in pretty good shape.
So most likely, if the wind on this approaching storm is causing a wind coming from the west hitting the building, am I more likely to be safe on the eastern side of that building?
I would think so, unless, of course, you can have another, it's not a guarantee, though, because you could have another structure or something that causes like a tunneling, and diverts the air as it goes around. But the key thing is to try to find an area, certainly inside a shelter, a closed area, a building, a car, or someplace anywhere where the wind doesn't move is probably your best bet. But like you're saying, yes, behind a building is always good, but just do the old wind test. See if there's anything moving. If the air is moving and you can feel a breeze, and you're not out of it.
Question. I'm going to agree with you when it comes to insulated structures. If it's a conductive structure, I think being near it, you're safe. The Fire Protection Code for New York City states that there is no documented evidence of a habitable structure adjacent to a well-grounded radio tower for that structure to ever be struck with lightning. There's a cone of protection around that tower. So if it's a metallic conductive structure, well-grounded, and you're near it, I think that's a safer place. Go ahead, Wesley.
I have a question that I actually got from Eric. How does the lightning strike from the top to the bottom, or from the bottom to the top? And another question is, if you have a difference of potential, the assumption would be that the negative is ground, the positive is air, or whatever up into the air. Then, we're dealing with the static, steady potential. What is the origin of the all frequency included in the striking, in the lightning strike, when we're dealing with the static positive and negative charges? Back to you.
I'm going to put forth a theory and then toss it over to Glenn to add his theory to it. Most negatively charged bottoms of clouds initiate the leader strokes. Not the lightning stroke, the leader strokes. In other words, you get a mild corona discharge, which happens in jumps of about 40 meters each. And those slowly propagate like tree branches, like an upside down tree, toward Earth. That is the leader function, the initiating function, the original corona discharges and whatever, starts from cloud toward ground most of the time. When that last branch of these leader strokes strikes ground and completes the path, now a tremendous amount of positive charge starts flowing from ground toward cloud, starts completing that path that has already been ionized by those leader strikes. So, does the lightning bolt progress from cloud to ground or ground to cloud? The answer is yes to both, depending on which portion of the process you're describing. So most lightning strikes initiate in the cloud, but the real completion, the real thunder clash, is a propagating wave, a very rapidly propagating wave, probably one quarter the speed of light, from ground to cloud. You take high-speed photography, you will see a propagation of the bright portion of the strike going from ground to cloud for a negatively charged bottom cloud. Let me drop. I've seen a number of pictures of the opposite, where the lightning, the whole great big lightning lit up tree in the photograph is no longer an upside down tree, it is a right side up tree, where now the leader strokes started at ground level and progressed in 40-meter steps toward the cloud. That's when the cloud is positively charged on the bottom. And when that cloud finally completes the path, you've now got a bright flash with high-speed photography, which will progress from cloud to ground. That's the more rare event. Those are the big, really loud, very destructive ones. And part of the reason for that is that I can find out from my Wimhurst machine that the negatively charged probe, let me drop, has objects on it with much, much greater mobility. If I set it up in such a way that there is that the negatively charged probe is aimed toward the center, not the tip, but the center of the positively charged probe, I'll hear a whole lot of hissing sounds, a whole lot of mobility of negative electron charges is taking place. It never builds up a significant voltage. It never gives me the normal zap, a real miniature lightning bolt that I get in this Wimhurst machine that can generate about 100 kilovolts. But if I reverse the procedure, if I take the positively charged probe, aim it toward the center of the shaft of the negative probe, now the high E field is near the positive probe. Those positively charged particles have much, much less mobility. They don't do this hissing sound discharge. And when the discharge finally does happen, I get a nice, loud zap. So if you want to see nice, consecutive lightning strikes in my Wimhurst machine, you must aim the positive probe toward the negative probe. Because the Wimhurst machine periodically decides reversing what polarity it generates, you got to do a test to find out which is the positive charge. So, what do you think about cloud to ground and ground to cloud, striking lightning, and which way things progress, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Well, from my dipole experiments and measuring voltages on a dipole, the charged voltage in the air doesn't lead me to believe that there is enough energy there to create an arc over or a problem. But the one thing we didn't talk about was temperature difference also. In other words, if you look at the storms where you have like warm air on one side and cold air on the other side, in other words, you've got that kind of storm that's going to come down and really cool things down, those are the ones that are kind of deadly. So you need a temperature difference too. I think that the reason that the lightning appears to start from the ground up, there again, I don't still think that the bolt is actually going down. It's a front moving from one direction to another. And you're seeing the arcing between those pressures so that it's really like a seam arc that's ripping as the air cloud is coming through, or that air pressure is moving through from warm air to cold air, and with all that density. So you've got a temperature difference, you've got a built-up difference in charge, and it's moving in. So because at lower altitudes, in other words, the closer you get to ground level, the differences in pressure are much more aggravated. In other words, you'll see much bigger pressure changes closer to ground than you will as you go up in altitude. So in other words, up at altitude, the only way you're going to get very, very high changes in air pressure is when you get two totally different clouds with an air gap in between, and then they start moving, rushing into each other. But I do think that if you've got two fronts of weather moving into each other, the biggest differentials in pressure and temperature will be at the lower altitude. And I think that's why you normally see it start from the bottom and then go, appear as if it's arcing upward, but it's really just the fronts between the two air masses as they come together. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
An origination of producing of all of these frequencies from two opposite charges. How that is happening?
Whenever there is a significant current that flows, by Faraday's law, a circulating magnetic field will flow around that conductor that has the charge. And if you've suddenly initiated a current charge, it's got a very steep leading edge to the current flowing. By definition, you have a very rapid build-up of the magnetic field around that conducting rod in my example, conducting wire. So the rapid buildup of a strong magnetic field, and if it's got a sharp enough leading edge to it, contains all the frequencies up to the point of 1 over the rise time, and then they start falling off real fast beyond that. That's essentially a Fourier series, impulse analysis. A single impulse with a fast enough rise time for a brief period of time contains all possible frequencies. The only thing that limits how high the frequencies go is how fast is the rise time. So a lightning bolt consists of an extremely large current flow, typically 11,000 amperes, with a rise time of a small fraction of a microsecond. It has all the criteria for a very rapid current rise, a very rapid magnetic field rise. Therefore, it contains all possible frequencies during that event, during that transient event. Now, Glenn, you just said something very interesting. Let me add a couple of words to it, or see if I can agree. Quite often the dry air front that has not had the storm yet is quite warm. And that warm air, by definition, is lighter in pounds per cubic meter. The leading edge of the storm front could be some real cold air. Even though wet air is lighter, because it is so much colder, I think the cold dominates. Therefore, the leading edge of the storm tends to scoot under the hot air and push it upward. And in so doing, the hot air being raised to a higher level where the temperature is lower, the pressure is lower, if there's even a little bit of moisture there, it can also contribute to this process of condensation. But this heavily charged cloud of cold air, the leading edge is cold, the center of the chimney, so to speak, is where the real convection is taking place. There's a lot of local heat being generated, heat of vaporization. But the leading edge of cold air, I think in some cases on that approaching storm front, sneaks under the warmer air that's in the dry area where you and I are located. And eventually you get a flow of air, the calm before the storm ceases, as the air in your area starts getting sucked into that chimney. And that's the beginning of the wind flow, I think, but I'm not sure. KT2QIQ, K2RIW.
Dick, I think we're on the same page on this one. I think that's exactly what's happening, that you have this chimney effect of the hot air being forced in and the other air is getting sucked underneath and the other air is being pushed and squeezed up. And it's a very, very violent activity at that area as it moves through. And there's a lot of energy exchanging there. And what's positive, what's negative, very hard to define. I think you can kind of put some, you know, you can maybe take apart a little piece of it. But remember, these are air currents moving and air masses, and you have terrain. And at ground level, the pressure differences, I think, are huge. And as I said, it tapers off as it goes up, of course, until it starts scooping underneath, like you suggested, and then forcing things up. And then you get all the arcing taking place in between at higher altitudes. So it's a very dynamic situation. And but I think, Dick, we're getting closer to a better way of describing how lightning is really taking place. Back to you, Dick. KC2QIQ.
I know I've asked you this question once before, but I think it's a good time to repeat it right now. During a hurricane, which quite often is a storm that's, well, let me pick a number, a good 100 miles in diameter, maybe 300 miles in diameter, but a good hurricane is multiple hundreds of miles in diameter. Lots of action is taking place. The total amount of energy dissipated during a hurricane can be equivalent to a good-sized atomic bomb going off once every single second. A lot of energy, tremendous numbers of joules. And the hurricane itself, in some circumstances, can last for a week, 7 solid days of the amount of energy being dissipated, equivalent to a good-sized atomic weapon going off once every second. During that week, with a tremendous amount of energy continuously being given off, if someone asked you, what is the source of that energy, Glenn, what would you say is the source of the energy? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
And the source would be the sun. Back to you, Dick. KC2 QIQ.
Without a doubt, the sun was the source. It heated up the local terrain during the previous week or so and gave you the ability to create that particular condition. The sun was the source during the previous week, month, or whatever. But during the hurricane itself, on a minute-by-minute basis, that's not sunshine doing it. What's doing it during the middle of that hurricane itself, Glenn? Go ahead.
I'm not sure. I know the basics makeup of the storm at that point, but maybe you better repeat it, because I'm not sure I know.
I say it's rain. Because the storm is, let me pick a number, 150 miles in diameter, and it's a very, very low pressure area, it is sucking in warm, moist, usually ocean air from a diameter of 150 miles. The number of cubic meters of warm, moist ocean air it's sucking in is just a number that's out of sight. All of that warm, moist air is being sucked into that center where there's an extremely low barometric pressure. It's rising to a higher altitude, lower pressure. All of that tremendous amount of millions and millions of cubic meters of air, moist air, is being converted into a very hard, violent rain. The conversion of water vapor into water liquid, 540 calories per gram, and millions of gallons of water per minute are being created from that warm, moist air. That's where all those zillions of joules are coming from. The hurricane is only sustained if it can continuously be sucking in warm, moist air to sustain that process. Once it goes over drier land, almost always the hurricane starts dissipating. So the rain is the real source of the energy during the event. Yes, the sun shined on that area of planet Earth during the previous month and heated up the water. And yes, you're getting all that energy back from the previous month or so. But during the event itself, I say it's rain. Same thing with a tornado. Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
Yeah, I would have to agree that the energy is definitely stored in the water. One of the most fascinating things about a hurricane, if you think about it in sheer numbers, just a bit, is look at the ocean and the amount of ocean. Like, if you were to look at the eye of a hurricane, and the hurricane's low pressure center in the center will actually raise the ocean levels feet. In some storms, I think they've actually measured the storm height. Which the average water height increase due to the low pressure in the center of a hurricane to actually raise the ocean temperature in that eye to levels above 10 feet, Dick. Is that amazing or what? Do we have any technology that you know of anywhere where we could lift that much ocean 10 feet above its normal sea level? K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Think about what you just said. You get a really level 4 or level 5 hurricane like Katrina moving over a very moist area like Louisiana, New Orleans, raising the water level by 10 feet. You've got a surge of wind pushing the water toward Louisiana and toward those dikes, and you have the low pressure area raising the water another 10 feet. Boy, look how easy it is to bridge those dikes when you put that all together. Back to you, Glenn.
It's really astonishing, and they're very, very scary storms. As a matter of fact, the storms I know the least about are these tornadoes. And, there's just another thing that, you read about the aftermath of these things, but, it makes you wonder, what is it that really, kicks them off? What gets them started? And the path of damage that they do, it's just, this. I should have probably been a meteorologist, Dick. I enjoy it almost as much as amateur radio. It's an area that completely fast. Mother Nature never continues to It always teaches me something new every day. Back to you, Dick. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Dick, question?
Westbury recognized. Yeah, weather is one hell of a mystery. It's one huge volumetric, seemingly random event, but it ain't random. Each cubic meter of all of that weather is obeying the laws of physics, a very complicated law, set of laws of physics. And tornado, again, all tornadoes have moist, warm air, rain, and lightning. Lots of it. You don't get a tornado without, again, the conversion of water vapor into liquid. You never get a tornado, a significant tornado, on a clear, dry day. It's got to be a warm, moist day with lots of rain happening somewhere. And the low pressure it creates, that chimney, is the aggravating factor that gives you that tornado. And the Coriolis effect is sucking in tremendous volumes of air that start spiraling toward the center by Coriolis. Into XJN, K2RIW. Go ahead, Wesley.
Into XJN. You said about the cosmic rays coming and ionizing a particle part of the atmosphere, and then my question is, what makes the cosmic ray ionizing this particle part of the atmosphere at this particular condition, and what is the power of cosmic rays?
The rate of cosmic rays would really scare the daylights out of all of us. I don't know the exact number, and you'd have to also define it. What energy level is your definition of a cosmic ray? I mean, you got cosmic rays, you got some weak ones and some strong ones. The majority of the cosmic rays are particles moving at very close to the speed of light, tremendous amount of energy in them. They strike the upper atmosphere. In many cases, the original cosmic ray itself doesn't make it all the way to the bottom of the atmosphere. It strikes a darn many air molecules at high velocity and starts a chain reaction. It's a little bit like a bowling ball hitting a great big field of bowling pins. And the bowling ball itself starts off very heavy, very fast, striking all these pins. And the bowling ball itself may not make it to the back end of the bowling alley, in my example. But it starts hitting these bowling pins at such high velocity, and now the high velocity bowling pins are what cascade down to you. So each individual cosmic ray striking the upper atmosphere creates a whole storm of high velocity particles moving down, secondary particles. And the rate at which they're happening is extremely high. I think each cubic centimeter of air has a significant number of secondary cosmic rays flowing through it every single second. We'll have to do a little confirmation on that one, but the number is high. In order for a lightning bolt to get initiated, let me drop. You need one of those secondary particles above a particular energy level coming through the near vicinity where that charge exists. The cosmic ray itself is striking a whole lot of individual air molecules, and each one of those impact ionizations is freeing up some electrons from each one of those air molecules that get impacted. And once you have a free electron alongside of the rest of that air molecule, it is a plasma. A plasma, by definition, is a conducting material. So this cosmic ray leaves a streak. Whether it goes through your cloud chamber, leaves a streak, or whether it goes in front of your rain cloud and leaves a streak. It's a conducting streak, and the charge will flow down that ionized conducting path. So it takes a little bit of coincidence-ness of the right level of energy of the particular cosmic rays in the near vicinity to initiate each one of those leader strokes. And on average, each one of them is roughly 40 meters long. Some of them are much shorter, some of them are a little bit longer, and so on. There's a whole lot of crazy statistics going on here. But the total number of cosmic rays is a very large number. How many of them have enough energy to do what we're talking about, that's another issue. How many of them are striking your body with enough energy to disturb your DNA is an interesting issue. There are people who think that almost all of the evolution of mankind is created by cosmic rays. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Very interesting. You take a balloon on the string. You have a 2 volts per meter difference. You put it up to the sky 10,000 feet. Well, whatever the number. I wonder, what is the factor of recharging? Because if you take the measurement between the ground and the end of that metal conductor, then you're going to have this voltage difference. But once you discharge that, how much time it takes to charge it again? That's why people didn't use it for as a battery. Back to you.
If I took a metal sphere that's discharged and I got it at ground level, and now I start raising it, and there's something in the vicinity of 2 volts per meter of dielectric potential difference in the air, and as I start raising it, that sphere, that metal sphere, has a certain number of picofarads to the rest of the universe, a relatively small number. But the air is a mildly conducting volumetric material, which has something in the vicinity of 2 volts per meter of vertical voltage gradient. As I raise that metal sphere, and if it's there for anything more than a couple of seconds at each individual altitude, the mild conductivity of that volumetric air will bring that metal sphere up to the potential of the local air. It's not going to remain at the potential it was at the ground. Or conversely, if I start off with it in the cloud, where it's charged 10 million volts compared to ground, and I slowly lower it to the earth, at each altitude as I lower it, it's being discharged by that mildly conducting air around it. It's not going to maintain the charge it had unless I could move it very fast. It's being slowly discharged. There's a leakage resistance. The air represents a leakage resistance, so there's an RC time constant. And I'll bet you there's ways we could calculate that time constant. And maybe the time constant is a fraction of a second. It's not very long. If it was hours, I could raise this metal sphere on a helium balloon, a great big helium balloon, get it up to the cloud, charge it up, bring it down real fast, and now I've got a million volts on that sphere. I don't think I can do that. I think as I lower that sphere, the RC time constant is much too fast. When I lower that metal sphere to the ground, I yank it down to the ground, it's going to be close to...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I have a sphere.
I think it's going to be close to ground potential. I think it's going to be close to ground potential even before I get it to the ground. I am guessing that the RC time constant is that fast. I wonder if that seems reasonable to you. Do you think that you know of ways that we can calculate that RC time constant, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
Dick, you have to excuse me. It's getting late. I got to go to work tomorrow, but I'll tell you, I'll be thinking about that during the week. It's going to be on my mind for sure. But I do have to bow out for tonight, guys. Let me say 73. It's always a pleasure, and hope to talk to you all either during the week or during next TechNet. This is KC2QIQ, saying 73 to all.
KEY.
Go ahead, Mel.
First, good night, Glenn. Take care. Question. If that factor of the sun shining down on the earth warms up the portion of the ocean and creates this condition that is conducive to forming a hurricane, why don't we have hurricanes continuous? Why does at certain times of the season, I'm sure that the sun must be shining down sufficiently enough to warming up, the South Atlantic to create this condition. But why does it seem that we only see this condition prevalent towards, midsummer or so, starting Dick?
Good question. I forgot the exact number, Mel. I keep remembering 85 degrees Fahrenheit, but that sounds a little bit too high. The local ocean must be at some very critical temperature or above, 84, 85 degrees Fahrenheit, I think is the number. When the ocean is at that temperature, the rate of evaporation is high enough that the air is now high enough in moisture content that it's capable of triggering this event. Most of those hurricanes, you realize, begin very close to the equator, where the ocean is hot as the hottest it can get on the Earth. And then they start propagating, the ones that get us start propagating toward the west and toward the north. But there's a minimum ocean temperature required. In the northern hemisphere in the winter, you don't get that minimum ocean temperature. You don't get enough moisture evaporation. You don't have enough moisture density in the air to trigger the event. That's what I think is going on. Back to you, Mel, KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
I went to sleep. No, well, okay. Now, you're talking about the northern hemisphere and during the summertime, the water warming up. All right, but it's the reverse process going on during the, when we have our winter, they supposedly have their so-called summer down in South America area and all. Why aren't they getting those hurricanes building up there? And maybe they couldn't move as much north because they don't have enough warm water. But you don't hear of any hurricanes really developing in, say, December, January, anywhere in the southern hemisphere, Dick, over.
I could be wrong, Mel, but I vaguely remember asking Google for a map of the hurricanes that strike Australia in our winter, which is their summer. I could be wrong, but I think there's a significant number of hurricanes that strike the shore of Australia. So the southern hemisphere, I think, also gets hurricanes. And by the way, what you and I call a hurricane, the people in Indonesia call it a monsoon. The people in Japan call it a monsoon. So I think the Pacific Ocean, I think the southern Pacific is getting those storms. They may give it another name, but I think they're getting those storms. Over to you, Mel.
Call them typhoons out in the Pacific. That's a typhoon. The monsoons are the storms that develop over the Himalayas and soak India, Pakistan, and all that area certain times of the year. But okay, let's say that hurricanes build up and you do get, yes, typhoons through the Pacific. But what's happening in the Atlantic? Why aren't we seeing the same situation in the Atlantic side? What is the difference between the Atlantic and the Pacific during the winter times that the storms don't build up? In other words, where are they? Why do they wait to a certain time when the water does not get to 85 degrees here in the northern portion of this hemisphere, but it does warm up sufficiently, you know, to further north than it normally does? But it seems like there's some kind of critical place somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean that something has to take place, Dick, over.
I'm going to guess, and I'm going to do a little research on this one, that if we ask for how many hurricanes or typhoons, whatever you're going to call them, strike the southern end of South America, below the Amazon, below the equator, I'll bet you there's not as many, but I'll bet you there are hurricanes that strike South America. I know the Atlantic, at various times, gets some really violent storms. That storm of where an aircraft crashed in the ocean and they can't find the parts of it. What time of year was that one? The French airliner that, I can't remember the name of the event right now. What month was that that airliner crashed in the middle of the South Atlantic and it was going through a really violent storm, and because the pitot tubes iced up and the automatic pilot system didn't know the real velocity of the airplane, it wasn't able to fly at the right speed to protect itself, and the airplane broke up in the air. Remember that event? I think that was our winter. I think it was like February when that happened, a year ago. Over to you, ML. KQLIW.
Definitely, it was from a flight from, I think, Brazil to Paris. And it was during our winter time. And, yeah, well, the crew they said, did not have the experience to understand that when the electronics started to show failure, what the heck the source of the failure is. In other words, they couldn't fly by, so-called, by their tail, you know, as the pilots of old used to say, you know. They just didn't rely so much on instrumentation as the way they knew what the airplane, you know, was capable of and what to do in situations. These people never had the experience because they did duplicate the process, what took place eventually, I could say, with the frozen pitons, that they did the same process, you know, in a trainer, in one of the simulators, and saw that most of the pilots had no experience in handling those situations. Too heavy reliability on electronics. But okay, it was a storm there. It was a storm. It wasn't considered a hurricane, really. It was just a violent storm, and that extended very high up into the atmosphere. But why don't we have continuous storms? In other words, why don't we have a continuous chain of hurricanes down the further south during the winter time, and the same situation up north like we get here? In other words, we only hear of the real severe hurricanes one after another here during the northern hemisphere during the midsummer to late summer. Over.
Okay, there's another theory. This one hasn't been proven. There was a PBS special, I think it was a NOVA program, on the subject of violent storms, and it turns out that every rainstorm is triggered by having a bunch of nucleation sites. In other words, even though I've got saturated air, I've got air that it has enough moisture content, it's water vapor, it's high enough, its temperature and pressure is low enough, that the water should be condensing. But you can always have supersaturated water. Just like your ice cubes, occasionally you can have supersaturated ice cubes. You can have ice cubes where the water itself is a couple of degrees below the freezing temperature, and ice hasn't yet formed. It takes nucleation, because ice is a crystalline form, and you need a seed crystal. Water vapor, when it's going to condense into liquid water, also needs a seed. The theory is, let me drop, that in Central Africa, where the prevailing wind is from the east toward the west, that the dust given up by the dry areas of Africa gets propagated into the air. Each of those individual dust particles become the nucleation site that starts the condensation process. So you don't even get rain if you don't have something for the individual raindrops to nucleate against. The theory is that every single raindrop has a small chunk of dirt in the middle of it, a small piece of dust that initiated that process. Every single snowflake has a small amount of dust to it. So the dust blowing from Africa triggers the rain over the 85 degree Fahrenheit hot water in the area and gets the whole process started. When you watch the carbonated water in your glass bubbling, you'll notice that the bubbles come from very specific locations in the bottom of the glass. That's the so-called nucleation site. Even though your carbonated water, let me drop, even though your carbonated water is supersaturated with carbon dioxide, and that carbon dioxide has to come out of solution as a gas, it still has a favorite location where it's going to do it. It requires a nucleation site. There's something about the sharp little point of the glass in the bottom of your drinking glass where you've got very specific sites where the bubbling takes place. You ever watch that happen, Mel? K2KEY, K2RAW?
Most definitely. But the point is, if the hurricane, as you said, stays over the ocean while it's over that warm water, it continuously builds and it doesn't die until it hits dry land, until it moves inland. If that be the case, why can't we create a hurricane in a pool? In other words, make this thing in a pool, supply warm water, supply air blowing over it. In other words, get the centrifugal, get the forces going, and then harness it. In other words, let Mother Nature then keep this thing going once we initiate it, or is that too far-fetched, over?
I think it's a scaling problem. There are certain procedures, certain processes, that when you decide to do it in a smaller and smaller environment, it doesn't happen anymore. That hurricane, which gets initiated as a tropical depression, and then eventually a storm, and the storm gets bigger and bigger, it requires a great big chunk of area, something in the vicinity of 100-mile, 150-mile diameter of moist air to really get it cooking. That you must be dragging in moist air from a 150-mile diameter circle around that perimeter. You're drawing in that air toward the center. There must be enough moist air at a high enough cubic meters per second rate ascending to a high enough altitude where the lower pressure and coldness of the higher altitude creates the condensation. When combined with nucleation devices, little flecks of dust, zillions of little flecks of dust, you have to have all of those conditions to really get this thing rolling. You and I don't have anywhere near enough area of that pool to create a big enough column of air rising to a high enough altitude to create enough decrease in pressure, to create enough decrease in temperature, to create enough rate of condensation, change from the vapor state to the liquid state. All of that's got to be enough volume at a high enough rate to sustain it. I mean, I can decide I'm going to run my internal combustion engine. Instead of running it at eight atmospheres of pressure, I feel like running it at...
Repeater, timeout, cancel. The time is 1 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30 W2VL repeater system. The time is 1:23 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL. Net tonight at 8:30. W2VL repeater system. Good morning. The time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.
KC2RQR Mobile. QR Mobile.
KC2. I didn't quite get that. IQI? I'm not sure. This is November 2 Echo Bravo M2EV. Name here is John.
Yeah, good morning, John. It's Kilo Charlie 2 Romeo, Quebec Romeo. Back to you.
Sorry about that, Anton. Quite recognize the voice. Well, you got in. That's great.
I'm coming out of JFK right now. I had to do a early morning drop-off. You know, these kids, I tell you, they're unbelievable.
Oh, yeah. So what is it? back to school or what?
No. She's going to hang out in California for a week. She's got laid off and, you know, stuff like that. Life is good in a big city when somebody else is paying the bills, you know?
All right, get away from it all. It's always good. It's always good. So, anyway, this started on my commute. Anyway, I heard the, on the news, I don't know how good it is, but they said the gas prices are supposed to drop. They said dramatically or drastically. I forget the word they used.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. You know, the whole thing about Osama bin Laden, I don't know. To me, it smells very fishy, but that's my personal opinion.
Yeah, you and a lot of people. I myself is, like, questioning, like, you know, a lot of different things. And you have to thank, and people are taking credit where credit is due to other people. So, that whole thing is like, you know, come on. What did you do? Stop playing it up. Yeah, let me see. Whoa, we got a slow-moving vehicle.
I'm only going to say one thing, and one thing only. And I want to drop it because you're lefty. Just stuff in the back of the court. I think they held that as an ace because there's no way this guy was sitting on the government's nose and the government didn't know about it. So they need to play that ace card and they pull the ace. That's basically what it is, they play the ace card.
Yeah, that's another whole side of it too. Anyway. So, you headed back home or you headed to work? What's going on?
Yeah, I'm going to meet you over there out in New York, but I got to do a bunch of paperwork, load up, and I got to head up north. Got to be in Westchester this morning, so. At least it's a nice day. I have no complaints. It's a sunny low 69.
Oh, yeah. All right, so then I'll see you later, and then I guess you said you got to head up to what, Westchester area. When are the R-88s or 188s coming? I think it's another a year and a half or so, right?
And two PPN motorcycle mobile.
You know it's going to be a nice day. He's a two-wheeler.
All right, station, now recognize. Station 2RQR mobile. No, the prototypes are here already, John. Prototypes are in Yonkers. So, let's see. By 2012, they should have the prototypes.
Okay, it goes over to Rich, and then I think John is in there also. So, enter PPN to get it. You pick it up, give it to HCB, then it goes back to EB.
Good morning, gentlemen. What's going on? Yes, it's a glorious day for a motorcycle ride. My high challenge brother, over to you. And to PBN.
I'm going to give a chart. Morning, Mr. Johnny EB. Any other station in there?
Yes, Whiskey 2, Hotel Charlie Bravo.
So, Richard, it comes around to you. Did you lay low? Did you stay out of eyesight? Did you stay out of gunfire? Inquiring minds want to know. I was grilling and laboring all day. Yes. That's what I was doing. Everybody's happy. Everything good. In the process of, oh boy. In the process of trying to do a little CPR on the family computer. In fact, I got a transfer happening right now, which might be done by the time I get home. long one. So, everything from the internal drive to the external drive. Gotta love it. Gotta love it. And hopefully the internal drive will last long enough to get all the info over. So, Mr. Evening, over to you. W2H.